Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. It's Thanksgiving, or the day after, depending on whether you're listening to WGRN or WCRS here in Columbus, Ohio, the city named after a famous murderer and torturer and raper and enslaver from Spain in a state named after the Seneca name for the river that borders us on the east and the south, which we have at times polluted terribly. And on this day, we celebrate a fictional encounter between the maybe-not-so-innocent Pilgrims from England and the Wampanoag people from Massachusetts. The legend goes that the Pilgrims, who were immigrants from the monarchic England escaping religious persecution, landed in Plymouth and set up a small village but lacked the survival skills to persevere. The Wampanoag allegedly welcomed them and fed them. In reality, the Pilgrims were not the only European invaders, and the Wampanoag were not the only local tribe they encountered. Indeed, the French were pushing southward from Canada, forming alliances with some bands of the Iroquois Federation, which itself was in the process of expanding and warring with neighboring tribes whose traditional territories they sought to annex. The Wampanoag formed an uneasy alliance with the Pilgrims, only as a bulwark against the French-allied Narragansetts. But the Pilgrims were not reliable allies, and had expansionist designs of their own, even prior to the alleged feast in 1621. British seafaring traders had captured and enslaved Wampanoag people on several occasions, and even slaughtered small groups of them on board their ships. They also brought foreign diseases that the people in North America had not developed immunological resistance to, and thus the Wampanoag and the neighboring Pequot tribes suffered incalculable attrition. Although the European colonists did assist the Wampanoag in fending off the Narragansetts for a while, they quickly turned against the Wampanoag too, seizing their lands and abducting them into slavery. Then in 1637, as the Pequot people gathered for their annual harvest celebration in November, the colonists attacked them savagely, clubbing and slashing them and burning them alive. About 700 people were killed in that massacre, and as with other massacres before and after that, the colonists held a celebratory feast. That, it seems, and not any shared meal between the Wampanoag and the Mayflower Pilgrims, was the basis for what we now recognize as Thanksgiving. It has since evolved to a more mercurial fiction, rewriting and indeed the erasure of real history, and, to a lesser point, a distraction from the fact that people all over the world have long traditions of seasonal celebrations around harvests and plantings and equinoxes and such. That could have been, and I would argue should be, the basis for a holiday at this time, and one that doesn't require a remassacring of history every year. To that end, go ahead and gather with family and friends and enjoy the social interaction, even if you pay no attention to past or present injustices. We all need to refuel and reconnect. And men, chip in with the cleaning, all right? But for today's show, we have a more contemporary, though historical, accounts of Native American struggles produced by Mark Torres of the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes the history out of the oldest and largest collections of public radio programming in the United States and puts it back on the radio. This week, we remember the 125th anniversary of the Wounded Knee Massacre with a program from 1998 when Pacifica commemorated the 25th anniversary of the American Indian Movement's occupation of three buildings on Wounded Knee Reservation in an attempt to force the U.S. government to relinquish Indian lands guaranteed in the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie. After a 71-day standoff, AIM leaders surrendered to federal agents in return for a promise to establish a commission to negotiate land issues and to address other Native American concerns. We will hear Charlene Teeters, an actuality of a concert from February 27, 1998, featuring the recently departed John Trudell, performing Shout Out a Jumping Bull and Great Spirit or Great Lie. But before we get to that concert, we begin with Voices of Pacifica series narrator Kathy Still introducing the program as a special Thanksgiving program broadcast in 1998.
We Welcome to Voices of Pacifica, where we explore the opinions and ideas of some of America's most intriguing public figures. I'm Kathy Still. This week on a special Thanksgiving edition of Voices of Pacifica, we hear from one of the most outspoken opponents of the inappropriate use of American Indian images, Charlene Teeters.
And I ask people about how much Indian education, how much Native American studies did you get during your public school experience? And of course, they think of Indians around Columbus Day. They think of Indians around Thanksgiving, and they usually, it's about putting on paper headdresses and doing this mock Thanksgiving feast. And then they forget about Indians the rest of the year.
We'll also hear music from the concert commemorating the 25th anniversary of Wounded Knee.
The company spoke to the high command. We need the deeds to the Indian land to dig for oil and uranium ore, and maybe have to start a little Indian war.
Charlene Teeters is a member of the Spokane Indian tribe in Washington State and a leader in the national fight to eliminate the use of racist Native American caricatures. She is the senior editor of Indian Arts Magazine, a professor at the University of American Indian Art, and a founding board member of the National Coalition on Racism in Sports and the Media. Teeters gained national notoriety as a graduate student at the University of Illinois when she led a high-profile protest against the use of Chief Illinois as the school's mascot. Her actions reignited calls across the country to challenge the inappropriate use of American Indian images and culture by schools, museums, corporations, and sports teams. Her story became the subject of the PBS documentary In Whose Honor? Teeters continues to work through her multimedia art installations, writings, and lectures calling attention to deeply ingrained perceptions, stereotypes, and racism towards American Indians. The following talk was recorded at California State University Fullerton on October 3, 1998.
I want to read this poem. One, because it helps me to relax a little bit, so we'll start with this. And it's a poem called I'm Not Your Princess. And it's from a collection of poetry called Not Vanishing. I'm not your princess. Sandpaper between two cultures which tear one another apart. I'm not a means by which you can reach spiritual understanding or even learn to do beadwork. I'm only willing to tell you how to make fry bread. 1 cup flour, spoon of salt. Spoon of baking powder. Stir, add milk, water, or beer until it holds together. Slap each piece into rounds, let rest. Fry in hot grease until golden. This is Indian food. Only if you know that Indian is a government word, which has nothing to do with the names we call ourselves. I won't chant for you. I admit no spirituality to you. I will not sweat with you or ease your guilt with fine turtle tails. I will not wear dancing clothes to read poetry or explain hardly anything. I don't think your attempts to understand us are going to work, so I'd rather you left us in whatever peace we can still scramble up. After all you continue to do, if you send me one more damn flyer about how to heal myself for $300 and special feminist counseling, I'll set fire to something. If you tell me one more time I'm wise, I'll throw up on you. Look at me, see my confusion. Loneliness, fear, worrying about all our struggles to keep what little is left for us. Look at my heart, not your fantasies. And please don't ever again tell me about your Cherokee great-great-grandmother. Don't assume I know every other Native American activist in the world personally. Or that I even know the names of all tribes, or can pronounce names I've never heard, or that I'm an expert at the peyote stitch. If you ever again tell me how strong I am, I'll lay on the ground and moan so that at last you will see my human weakness. Like your own, I'm not strong. I'm scraped. I'm blessed with life while so many I've known are dead. I have work to do, dishes to wash, a house to clean. There is no magic. See my simple cracked hands which have washed the same things you wash? See my eyes dark with fear in a house by myself late at night? See that to pity me or to adore me are the same. One cup flour, spoon of salt, spoon of baking powder, liquid to hold. Remember, this is my recipe. There is many others. Let me rest here, at least. Can you hear me okay? Yeah? Can I have some water? Somebody get me some water. Over the past 150 years, popular culture has grown into a powerful source of information, selling to Americans and the world a global perception of American thinking. Among those thoughts is a pervasive global image of American Indians. And within that global image, popular media has successfully candy-coated racial attitudes towards Native people. From sports team mascots to tourism, American Indians are things. Things to be examined, things to be sold, things to be entertained by, things to create colorful legends about, things to claim spiritual clemency, things to strike fear with, things to be backdrops, things to be mined. But never full-fledged human beings. To the Boy Scouts of America, Indians are campfire stories or survivalist experts. To New Agers, American Indians are spiritual giants. To the states of New Mexico and Oklahoma, we're tourist attractions. To anthropologists, Indians are objects of study, objects of curiosity. In Germany, Indians are romantic savages. To the University of Illinois, Florida State Seminole, and 141 schools in California, we are slaves for entertainment. These Indians don't exist for me. We are human beings. When you translate our names for ourselves, it translates to mean the human beings. We are the human beings, the original people, the real people. It's hard for us to understand why today we are still talking about, still struggling with this basic issue, the humanity of Indian people. And this is what we're debating. This is what's going on around the country. To quote my friend Michael Haney, he says, the longest undeclared war in history is the war against the American Indian here in our own homeland. History plays an important role as to whether or not an act, a symbol, is racist or not. It was only a generation ago, during the civil rights movement, that we heard, we don't mean anything derogatory by calling you boy or Negro. These definitions come from the dominant society. Boy was a way for the dominant society to dehumanize African Americans. It was a way to keep from referring to them as a human being with rights of human beings. History plays an important role in determining whether an act, a term, a phrase, a symbol is racist or not. The history of white America and African Americans is a history of domination and subordination. As long as the dominant society is allowed to define the group, in this case African Americans, then the old relationships are sustained. The same is true for Native Americans. We have a long and ongoing history of genocide, forced removals, forced assimilation. These symbols that are used across the country, which is used to kill the culture. The process of genocide continues through the use of those symbols, the cultural genocide of the people. Redskin refers to a time when you could make money off of killing Indians. And that was referring to a pelt or a skin. You made so much money by bringing in the bodies of Indian people. And when it was too cumbersome to bring in bodies, you brought in heads. When it was too cumbersome to bring in the heads, you brought in the red skins or the scalp of Indian people. And you got more money if you brought in a scalp that had the ears attached. And they sold many of these pelts to England, and they became part of those wigs that they used to wear, the elite, those powdered wigs. That's where some of our ancestors' scalps went to. The Indian head, not so much unlike what we see, these caricatures, the little red Sambo, were on businesses. And when you saw that decapitated head on the businesses, you knew that was a place you could take your scalp to collect bounty, your bounty. The tomahawk chop refers to a violent history in America. And sometimes we hear, well, braves, that's not so bad. Braves is a character. But we know that they refer to our men as braves in the same way they refer to African Americans as boy, so that they didn't have to acknowledge that they were human beings. It was a way to refer to them and so that they didn't have to acknowledge they were human. That brave and that squaw. They couldn't say man and woman or husband and wife. They had to find a way to dehumanize us. And chief, how many of you people of color have been called chief? Hey chief, I'll get to you in a minute. It's a way to refer to them as something less than human. I gave a talk in Chicago, and there's an African-American man who stood up, and he says, I finally understand why I keep getting called chief. And he says, because they can't say boy anymore. They can't say anymore. And so they'll say, hey, chief. The school system. These symbols inflict the pain of our history when our school systems use these images, where these symbols are being played out and played with on primetime television, using images and icons that are central to our identity. And we can't protect our children from this antics of the fans, because on primetime television, they're turning on the TV and there's the tomahawk chop. There are people playing with the central symbols of our identity. These young people that are up here dancing, you know, it gives me so much hope when I see our young people and that we have these strong families who are working very hard to instill a sense of pride in our young people and who they are. When we see these young people up here dancing, we know that things will be okay, but it is hard for them. It's hard for these young people that were up here dancing because every time they turn on that television, they see those things that they've been taught to respect being trivialized, being played with. We have a lot of work to do. These symbols that are put forward by educational institutions, which interfere with the true mission of an educational institution, which is to teach history, to tear down stereotypes, not reinforce them. And it creates a hostile environment for our young people who go to school in that 141 schools. When they go, they can't just go to be a student. They're going to be asked, what do you think about this symbol? And then they're going to be treated accordingly. They're either going to be a good Indian or they're going to be a bad Indian. And so they become kind of a litmus test for us. Wilma Mankiller, the former principal chief of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, came to the University of Illinois to give a talk when I was there as a student. And after her talk, she was asked by the press, what is the number one priority for your nation? And and people thought, well, she'll talk about economic development or housing maybe or social programs. And her response to the press was, the number one issue for our nation is to get our young people to believe in themselves again, to trust their own thinking, because our public school systems still teach them today that they have inferior minds. And through the exclusion of Native American history in the curriculum, they are taught that we contributed nothing to American society, that everything Indian is inferior. So our struggle as leadership, tribal leadership, as community leaders, is to get more of our young people through this very hostile environment, the public school system, and hopefully get them through, you know, a college system where, again, their identity is going to be attacked, so that we can be telling our story, so that we can write the history books, write the scripts, stand in front of the classroom and be the professor. We struggle to get more of our people through this very hostile environment. In LA County, during this mascot debate, we heard some incredibly ignorant comments coming from students, coming from community members, coming from administrators, coming from teachers. Ignorance is our biggest enemy. We have to deal with very, very basic issues, very basic questions when Indian issues is brought up. And it speaks to the mass miseducation of America. No college student should go through 4 years of college in this country without taking Native American studies. And if they did, maybe then they would learn to respect the peoples whose land they now occupy. And I ask people about how much Indian education, how much Native American studies did you get during your public school experience? And of course, they think of Indians around Columbus Day. They think of Indians around Thanksgiving, and they usually, it's about putting on paper headdresses and doing this mock Thanksgiving feast. And then they forget about Indians the rest of the year. And when you ask people, how much Native American history did you get? The average person that tells me across the country, they tell me about 2 weeks. You know, if they like crunched it all up to the same time, that's about how much they get. This is the ignorance that I'm talking about, because Americans cannot come to terms with the history, the true history of how Native people have been treated in their own homeland. I have a master's in fine art from the University of Illinois. And I like to refer to it as my master's in Caucasian studies, because everything is taught from their point of view, everything. Our storytellers, who are our educators, tell us that we have been here. Native people have been here since the beginning of human memory. That our people, Our bodies, our blood is a greater part of this earth than any other people. So when we walk on this earth, we are walking on the ashes of our ancestors. When you ask the elders, who are we? They will tell you, we are our language. We are our culture. We are our songs. We are our stories. We are our history. We are our names for ourselves. And we are our own images for ourselves. That's who we are. This is what we're protecting. This is what we're passing down to the next generation. If we lose those things that are central to our identity, then we become just another color in this country. We're just another color. Our ancestors, those storytellers in our language, it translates into the keepers of the sacred truth. That's how important our storytellers are. They are our educators. The last process of genocide is to take the images, the cultural icons of the people being colonized, to reinvent them, distort them, and then impose them on the people as a further way to kill the culture. And this is what is happening today. And this is what this debate is about. It is the last process of genocide. History, the presentation of history is powerful depending on who has it, who holds it in their hand, who controls it. When your enemy has your history in his hand, he will interpret it any way he chooses, and they do. Our history has been held hostage by universities, by museums, by anthropologists. And they interpret it any way they choose. And they will tell you, students who are going in the public school system, that your history and my history is the same. This is what they will tell you. And they will use your history, to deflate you. You must learn your history. You must learn your history. Learn who your freedom fighters are, because they don't want you to know their names. They only want you to remember the names of those people who helped the white man colonize America. Learn the names of your freedom fighters. Learn your history, and you must use your history to inspire you. History is very powerful, depending on who holds it in their hands and who controls it. Our history is being used against us by these educational institutions. They are using distorted history, distorted images to deflate us, to deflate our young people, to deflate our future leadership.
You are listening to Native American artist and activist Charlene Teeters.
You can obtain a copy of this program and other public radio programs by calling 1-800-735-0230.
In New York recently, maybe you saw it in the news, there was a parade where firefighters and policemen were dressed up in blackface. Did you hear about this? And they were making light of the dragging death of that African-American man in Texas. And these firefighters and policemen were throwing watermelons to the crowd, and they were dragging one of their co-workers behind a truck, and he was blackface. And it outraged the community. The mayor of New York fired those men because he was so outraged at what he saw. But remember, when they were doing that, when they were throwing the watermelons out, when they had their black face on, there was a crowd there too. And the crowd didn't say anything. They're responsible too for standing back and letting that happen. And as much as that was so horrible that that happened today, just about a month ago, but every day in America, on school yards, people are wearing red face, and nobody notices. The same thing is happening. Somewhere in America, somebody is wearing red face, and no one noticed. This tradition of dehumanizing Indian people continues in Atlanta, Washington, Kansas City, Cleveland, University of Illinois, Florida State Seminoles, where these fans wear paint, wear bonnets, shake tomahawks, play drums, and chant Hollywood's war chants. In virtually every public school system in this country, someone is using Indians alongside gophers, bears, beavers. What we have here in California in the 141 schools is the local definition of a national problem. It is a national problem. For those people who want to trivialize this issue, they say we have more important issues. Poverty, high suicide rate. We know. Because, you know, those aren't statistics to us. They have names attached to them. Those are our relatives. We know. But racism is never trivial. If it stands in the way of a people's self-identification and self-determination, it is an issue for us. When you dehumanize a people, then we are vulnerable to all kinds of acts of racism and violence that we face every day in Indian country. Whose issue is this? It's everybody's issue, everyone's responsibility. If you consider yourself an anti-racist, this is your issue too. To reduce the victims of genocide to a stereotype symbol or mascot is immoral. And as long as this country wants to do this on primetime television, and that this nation's capital has as their identity the Redskins, we continue to be a nation in dishonor. I want to just close with these comments that comes from Alice Walker. Alice Walker said these words after seeing a collection of caricatures and stereotypes of African American people. And so I'm an artist, and I did an installation of artwork. And so I took her words and just changed it a little bit. And I want to read this. And remember, she's talking about these caricatures and stereotypes. These caricatures and stereotypes are really intended as prisons of image. Inside each desperately grinning Cleveland Indian and stoic Redskin brave or Chief Illiniwek, there is someone we know. If you look hard at these symbols and don't panic, you begin to see the eyes and then the hearts of these despised relatives of ours who have been forced to lock their spirits away from themselves and from us. I see our brothers and sisters, mothers and fathers, captured and forced into images they did not devise, doing hard time for all of us. We can liberate them by understanding this and free ourselves. Thank you.
You've been listening to a talk by Native American artist and activist Charlene Teeters. She spoke at California State University Fullerton on October 3rd, 1998. On February 27, 1973, American Indian Movement activists occupied three buildings on the Wounded Knee Reservation in an attempt to force the United States government to relinquish Indian lands guaranteed in the 1968 Treaty of Fort Laramie. After a 71-day standoff, AIM leaders surrendered to federal agents in return for a promise to establish a commission to negotiate land issues and to address other Native American concerns. The following music from the commemoration concert took place on the second night of the three-day event on February 28, 1998. The festivities begin with Steve Emery performing Hoka Blues.
Hotel ride. I believe that Denver has the biggest dance around. Yeah, when we were singing all around us through the crowd. So we sang all the coaster songs long, high, and loud.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are about to kick this off. This is winding up the 25th anniversary of the Wounded Knee Liberation. 25 years of cultural and spiritual growth and freedom and liberation for the Oglala Lakota people, for all the Indian people in the Western Hemisphere. Welcome! My name is Andy Mader. I'm the son of Bernard Mader and Monase Little Boy from the Concho Agency in Oklahoma. I'm a Southern Cheyenne from down that way, and I'm very honored to be asked here by Mr. Edgar Bearrunner, Mr. Robert Quiver Jr., who came down to Phoenix to help us with a concert in November, and they asked me to come up here and MC this concert. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm pumped. I'm excited because I've already seen who's going to perform, okay? I heard the sound checks. I saw these people coming in here, tuning up their instruments, how they looked in the lights, and we are going to rock this joint tonight. That's all there is to it. I want to bring somebody to the stage real quick. I absolutely fell in love with the strength and character of this young lady when I met her a few months ago, and she's here to welcome you on behalf of the people who put this all together, the people who brought this entire event around to be, who worked with the tribal councils and with the people, to welcome you all here to the Little Wound School in Kyle, South Dakota for this grassroots tribute concert, this musical tribute. Please welcome to the stage Miss Corey Trimble.
Hello, my name is Corey Trimble. My Lakota names are Wambli Weakawi and Wanakchawi, which means Eagle Feather Woman and Flower Woman. My great-grandparents' names are Ben and Emma Bravehawk, and my grandmother's name is Mary Rose Crazy Thunder Dillon. My mother's name is Emmeline Eagleheart, and my father's name is John Trimble. First of all, I would just like to thank everyone who has come here today. It's really great to see all the young people and everyone who has gathered here, both young and old, to come together for something that means so much to all of our people. And I'm young, I don't understand everything that went on, and I probably never will. But maybe that's good because things are changing and times are moving on, and we need to start healing our people so we can move on and get better. The idea of the Wounded Knee, the 25th anniversary of the Wounded Knee occupation, it started first as an idea of a celebration. And it is a celebration, but it came to mean more than that. It came to be a time of healing, a time of reawakening, so all our people can unite with all these issues that are coming before us today. And I just want to address the youth today. I think it's really important that the youth, you know, understand their role. And everyone understands their role in living in today. Everyone has a role, and we all need to work together. The young people need to go back to traditional ways, to stay away from alcohol and drugs, to go back to, and talk to their elders, talk to their parents, so they can understand what is going on and understand how alcohol and drugs is affecting all of our lives, and that we need to heal ourselves from that and grow and move on so we can heal all of our people. And I just want to say I'm very honored to be here. I'm very honored to stand up here today before you and have this opportunity to give you this welcome. And I just want to thank all of you for coming from everywhere. Everyone has come from everywhere, and it's really a strong feeling to see all of you here and to see everything going on, and it gives me hope for our future. And I want to thank you. Pilamayaye Madakyase.
This man, a few years ago, he had a distinction, and he's got a distinction today of being something that none of the other performers tonight, I don't think, well, yeah, maybe one or two, you never know, you know, but this gentleman's definitely a troubadour. In fact, he is the troubadour for the American Indian Movement. He was also in Wounded Knee in 1973. He's one of the liberators of Wounded Knee. His name is Dave Baker. He's traveled all the way down here to be with us. He's a political activist. He writes and sings songs about Indian people and about Indian politics and about how we got to live and how we got to survive in this day and age. And he's going to come up here and tell you about it in his own special style. But a 1973 Wounded Knee veteran, a Wounded Knee occupier, a Wounded Knee liberator, a member of the independent Oglala Nation, please welcome to the stage Red Bird.
There's a time to think about the east to the west influx of the European immigrants onto this continent. This song is called From the East Came Freedom. Thank you. From the east, a cross appeared, as brilliant as the sky. We gathered in the distance, and we watched as it went by. A tree was in its way, but it didn't go around. That's when we knew the cross was a sword stuck into the ground. The strange men who followed this cross were said to be of Christ. In order that these men should live, the enemy would sacrifice. We were the hands that gave them food, and we let their freedom grow. But they soon forgot about the red man, as everybody knows. Freedom? Yes, freedom. Sing it to the sky. And the red man said, without the tree, that mankind would surely die. And the red man said, without the tree, that mankind would surely die. From the east came the wagon trains, rolling across the ground. They followed the path of the fallen tree that the cross had just cut down. Wagon trains went rolling west, bringing hunters by the score. That's when we knew this paradise would be a paradise no more. Then rode in two were the men dressed in blue, who'd keep this great land free, like the massacre at the Little Bighorn in a battle called Wounded Knee. A child at Sand Creek would never end the day. And the only good Indian is a dead Indian, General Sheridan would say. Freedom? Yes, freedom. Sing it high and low. And the white man said, we'll keep these treaties for as long as the grass shall grow. And the white man said, we'll keep these treaties for as long as the rivers flow. From the east came churches with bells that chimed away. They gave us rags in turn for riches, and it's called the Christian way. They preached their book of hate while the black man fell at their knees. The trail of tears took many years, but they reached the Western Sea. When her sword has cleaved the last tree, polluted all the waters in this land, then and only then will the white man understand. Yes, then and only then will the white man understand. Freedom? Yes, freedom. Sing it and give thanks. And the red man said, you can't be fed with all the gold that's in your banks. And the red man said, you can't be fed with all the gold that's in your banks. And I don't mean Dennis Banks.
That was Redbird Dave Baker doing From the East Came Freedom. Now, John Trudell performs Shootout a Jumping Bull and Great Spirit or Great Lie.
Shootout a Jumping Bull. Remember the elders. Remember the women, the children. Remember a wounded knee. There are times when you run out of running. If you don't create justice, justice isn't coming. Firefight in an Oglala afternoon. There are white men shooting. Brothers, get the guns. All our relations in this together. From Columbus to now, there is no safe place. From now until tomorrow, we are the chase. Shoot out at jumping ball. Remember the people. Remember the way. Under siege, the people under attack. Thieves armed with laws and weapons. The 7th Cavalry hunting for any signs of life. My relatives, we are our ancestors. Ancient ones light our path. Pray for the people. The slavers are here. Continue on, my relatives. The people will live. It's like after all these things have happened, like this is what, 25 years since Wounded Knee, and in that last 25 years, America broke my heart and broke my mind. Kind of messed up my spirit. But I think that's where healing is. It's about within our spirit and our mind. And I had to look at reality all differently than I had ever looked at it before. And going back in to find what that reality is, because when the world changes, it changes, man. And even if nobody else sees it, once it's changed, and you can't put it back. So you have to really, to me, you have to really look at, well, what is really real here? You know, it's like, I know there's the great spirit, but I also know there's the great lie. I mean, we call it civilization or whatever we want, but it's like, that's to me what's going on, the great spirit or the great lie. You know, like you look at who we are, you know, how do we recognize ourselves anymore? I mean, we're the people. You know what I mean? Human being. The human, the bone, flesh, and blood. The being is the spirit. The spirit, that's the being part of human. And the human part of being, the bone, the flesh, and the blood, is made up of the waters and minerals and liquids of the earth. We are different shapes of the earth. That's what we are. That's why in our ancestry we always said all my relations, and why we always say it now. See, but I don't know how clearly we remember that anymore in the lives that we are surrounded by. And it's like, to think about what is happening to us, this genocider that has come. You know, they can call it assimilation, they can call it whatever they want to, new world order, progress, you know, they can call it whatever they want, but it's a genocider. It's like an energy vampire. See, a way that it works is like, we know that if they take uranium, the DNA of the earth in the shape of uranium, we know if they take it out of the ground and they mine it by putting it through a refinement process. And when they put it through the refinement process, they take the spirit of that uranium, and through the refinement process, they convert that spirit into energy, and then they use that energy to run their technologic reality. And they do it with petrol fuel and crude oil. They take that DNA and the spirit of that DNA, and they put it through a refinement process, and they convert it into energy. But we got to think about us, the human part of being, the DNA, the bone, flesh, and blood, the minerals, metals, and liquids of the earth. And with the being, the spirit, we're like a uranium with spirit. They take the human part of our being and they put it through a refinement process that they call technologic religious civilization. And they feed that human through that refinement process, and they convert our spirit into an energy that they feed upon, and they create their authoritarian structures and the great lie, and they make it work. They mine us. And like, we know how all of the pollution went from the poison of the uranium and how all of that pollution works. We see how that poison comes and it makes that pollution, or the fossil fuel pollution, or all of the pollutions that are made from these mining processes. Then when we look inside of who we really are, the human being, who we really are, every fear, doubt, and insecurity we have, that's the pollution left over from the mining of our spirit. And it's a deliberate thing. It works. This has been going on for a long, long time. So the best I can come to understand it is, well, then all of this takes place in the mind. All physical genocide, all things that happen, this is done to win a war in our mind. It is done to change our perception of reality. To change our perception of reality. But that's like when Columbus came here. See, we relate to Columbus coming here as a man. came on a boat with other men. See, but maybe Columbus was like really a virus. See, a virus. And this virus, it diseases the spirit. And when the spirit becomes diseased, and the more diseased the spirit becomes, the more affected the perception of reality is. So this virus came out of Europe. And when this virus came here in the form of these human beings, this mining process, this feeding, we look at the Europeans when Columbus came. At that time, they had been 400 years into the Great Inquisition, and the Great Inquisition in Europe was when the church did to the descendants of the tribes of Europe. It did to them what they ended up doing to us when they got here. So 400 years before Columbus came, the church decided that it was the authority of God. It was God's government on the earth. And that all of these, and at that time, the peasants and the serfs, see, they were the descendants of the tribes of Europe, but they didn't know they were tribes anymore because by that time they were serfs and peasants and had been owned by whoever owned the land, landlords, by whoever owned the land, then they were owned by them. So they didn't remember they were tribes anymore, but they remembered the old ways and they prayed to spirits and they understood where the woman fit in the society. So they had all of these old ways and were practicing them because they were still a part of the land that was bought and sold. So the church said, no more of this. We need to save those souls. We want them. So they created the Inquisition, and the Inquisition was basically this. If you were accused of disagreeing with the church, you were guilty of heresy. And if you were guilty of heresy, if you were accused, you were guilty. And if you were guilty, you had to be tortured. And then you had to be executed. And then all your property had to be seized by the state or the church. See, so millions of people were killed in that 400 years before Columbus came here. So it's a complete brutalization and terrorization. And an interesting thing that came out of that, The descendants of the tribes of Europe, they had to learn to love what they feared. This is when love and fear were put together. They feared the church, but in order to stay alive, just physically stay alive, they had to love it. So love and fear became inseparable. So by the time Columbus came here, these people did not know life anymore. So when they came here and they met our ancestors said, we are the human beings. We are the people. And these guys said, all I see are Indians. They couldn't see us. They couldn't see human beings because they didn't know they were human beings anymore. Because it had been 400 years since they had been treated like a human being, even minimally. Let's say 20 years to a generation. 20 generations. So when they came here, they did not know what a human being was. Their spirit was completely possessed and diseased. And they no longer had a real perception of reality. And the great lie, the great illusion, was now their new reality. See, there's a reality, a spiritual reality, and a religious reality. There are more, but when it comes to about who we are and where we're from and about beginnings and continuation and ancestry, when it comes to the creation story, there's a spiritual perception and a religious perception. The spiritual perception is about responsibility. About responsibility. That's the spiritual perception of reality. The religious perception of reality is about guilt, sin, blame, submission, and authoritarianism. And none of those things have anything to do with responsibility. So they mine us in these kinds of ways. Happiness is how we feel about ourselves. The good we think, the good we feel, the good we do. We are part of the dream time. Happiness is one of the colors. There are shadow casters who trick us about happiness. We are taught to wish for things to make us happy. We are not taught to dream for happiness itself. We can't buy happiness, we can't sell it, we can't steal it, we can't borrow it, and we can't capture it. But we can create it. Love can't bring us happiness, but happiness can bring us to love. Power can't bring us happiness, but happiness can show us power. On the line of what is real and what really isn't. Dream for happiness. Somewhere between heart and mind, the spirit of life can be seen. Happiness comes in a way to dream, and I thank you.
You've been listening to a 1998 program commemorating the 25th anniversary of the American Indian Movement activists' occupation of three buildings on the Wounded Knee Reservation. For a copy of this program, call us in the archives at 1-800 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is produced for the Pacifica Radio Network by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, with support from the Pacifica Radio Archive staff, Sean, Edgar, Jolene, Joseph, Mariana, and our dedicated volunteers. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archive's Preservation and Access Project, rescuing our history for the future to learn from. Thanks for listening and keeping our history alive.
That was a special Thanksgiving edition of From the Vault, recordings from the vast Pacifica Radio Archives library. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all next week for another edition.